Okay, welcome back, everyone. Today we have three items on our learning agenda. Number one, to complete our discussion of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Number two, to look at a transitional personality, in particular leading toward the third item, or third personality we're looking today, namely the Rambam. So we have Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that transitional figure is just alluding to someone by the name of the Rimigash, we'll look at very briefly, but just to sort of contextualize where it is, that's number three, the Rambam is coming from. The Rambam obviously will not conclude in one third of a class, but we will have the opportunity hopefully to give a quick biography of the Rambam and sort of frame our discussion of this titan, one of obviously the most outsized influential personalities in all Jewish history, not just medieval Jewish history, and as they say, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam kemoshe. Right? From Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe ben Maimon, there was no one like Moshe. So clearly, one of the most decisive influences in all of our thinking, in all Jewish history, and we'll give the Rambam a number of sessions, and you'll see how we'll do that moving forward. This. So the first piece is to conclude our discussion with Halevi. And I wanted to, I thought it would really be derelict to have only focused on his philosophical work, the Kuzari, without at least some amount of attention toward his incredible contributions in the realm of Jewish poetry, Jewish song, etc., of piyut. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi has a range of different kinds of poems, as we've mentioned. He has what is falls generally under the genre of secular poetry at that time. He was extremely involved with the higher class of Islamic poets, involved in their public spaces in places, in towns like Seville and elsewhere, in joining with them in crafting poetry. There are extensive collections of his of his poetry that have been published as secular and religious. The religious poetry has survived better just because the secular poetry, there wasn't necessarily anyone who was particularly interested in ensuring its survival per se. The religious poetry received significantly more attention in later generations and clearly was profoundly influential. Now, there are full collections of all the extant, or much of the extant poetry of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which is really worth going through and examining. He wrote piyutim on a range of topics. He wrote piyutim for many of the holidays. And we'll look at what's probably the most famous of his poems, which is written or is generally recited in a relatively sober, sad context, namely Tisha B'Av. But at the same time, among the keynote of Tisha B'Av, among those elegies, is really one of the most forward-looking and optimistic. Really, with the piyut of Tzion Halo Tishalim, which we're about to examine, really the mood of the keynote, of the Ashkenazi keynote anyway, on Tisha B'Av really changed. I believe it's also in the Sephardic, you know, he was a Sephardi, but I'm most familiar with the Ashkenazic version. And in the generally printed Ashkenazic version of the keynote, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's poem, Tzion Halo Tishalim, appears in number 36. So basically what you have is the first five keynote that are printed are generally recited on the night of Tisha B'Av, and then the subsequent 45 or so are recited in your standard Ashkenazic Sidurim, are recited during the day of Tisha B'Av, beginning with about 15 of the keynote of the elegies of Rabbi Yehuda HaKalir. And HaKalir, also one of the most outstanding paitanim in Jewish history, an extraordinary personality and figure in his own right, even though his history and his biography are shrouded in some mystery. We then come to a number of other keynote, in particular after those of Eliezer HaKalir, we come to those that are not only focused on the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but other events in Jewish history. We come to the Crusades, a number of Ashkenazi keynote. Again, a number of keynote focused on that particular event and other tragic moments, the burning of the Talmud in France in 1242, events along these lines. And then we come number 36. Ultimately, we arrive at the keynote of Tzion. The keynote of Tzion really occupy an entire section of the keynote, numbers 36 through 44. In other words, taking us toward the very end, are essentially all keynote of Tzion. They're not written all by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Only the first, which we'll be looking at, is written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. But his Kina of Sion Halotishali spawned an entire literature of entire genre of Sion Piyutim. That's how influential he was. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote the first Sion, and then you have all sorts of later Paitanim mimicking his style, mimicking his opening and his general themes, writing their own versions of Sion. And in fact, some 9 keynote have survived. That's 9 out of the 45, right? So there's essentially 1/5 of reprinted Ashkenazic keynote are written by or inspired by or are in mimicry, in the best of the senses of the term, of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which is itself not all you need to know, but a lot of what you need to know in terms of just how outsized his influence was. This, of course, is a very famous kina, in part because it inspired modern Hebrew songs. As we will see, we're not going to read the entirety of this kina, but we can also focus a lot of attention, which I won't do for now, but just I think it bears mention in terms of the technical aspects of his poetry. In other words, the rhyme scheme, the meter, some of the literary or poetic devices that he employs, which are common to other poems of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, in which he draws from and modifies for Hebrew language some of the various technical skills and tools, the techniques that were used by poets of his era. And we can see many of those here. We'll get a sense of those. We're not going to do that in depth. But the technical side of what it means to write a kina and what makes something free-flowing and yet beautiful in form clearly is something that animates and helps to elevate this piyut. What's remarkable about Halevi is that despite his technical virtuosity, he somehow seems to transcend that. In other words, for some poets, that they feel so confined to a certain kind of structure that it sort of loses something in the process. You have other poets who write in a very free-flowing style, don't feel bound by any sort of rules or techniques, etc. But very often you get the sense that things are chaotic or unmoored and there's really no rhyme or reason or inner coherence. And what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, part of his masterful stroke, part of his virtuosity as a poet, and you can really see that here, is that he manages to marry both beautifully. He's got the technical side, and yet somehow that doesn't limit him. It allows him to have a platform to go beyond that and to really transcend it and to write something extraordinarily beautiful. Again, as the genre of Tzion Piyutim that it spawned clearly provide testimony for that. So let's read parts of it. We won't read the whole thing, but just to get a sense. So he begins, Tzion halotish ali l'shlom asirayach. So what he does here is interested in a very interesting move. He opens not only with the word Tzion as sort of the key phrase here, but a motif. But what he does is he addresses Tzion, the city, directly. So he's not speaking about Tzion. There's a personal relationship. There's an act of personification, right? As our first, immediately there's that first literary device that he employs. Tzion halotish ali l'shlom asirayach. Tzion, will you not ask or inquire as to the shalom, as to the peace of your asirayach, of your imprisoned ones? In other words, the Jewish people who are in exile, exile is comparable to one who is imprisoned, and so therefore he pleads with Sion herself, will you not inquire as to the peace, the welfare of your imprisoned ones? Ador sheh shalomech, you start to see here also a little bit of the alliteration, which will become even more manifest as we go forward. Halotish ali l'shlom asirayach, right? Or she shilomech, right? The shins here, right? Together with the lamids, right? Tish ali l'shlom shlomech, right? The repetition of shalom, right? Clearly, there's that alliterative motif. V'hem yeter adarayach, and they are the remnants of your flock. And here also we see we could do the meter, and there's a clear scheme in that regard, and then the rhyme scheme is also obvious, at least at this point. The first two are going to rhyme, as if you just scan moving forward each of the stanzas till the very end of the kina, the piyur, end with, right, adarayich, right, that yod chaf, right, and that particular sound, avarayich, ararayich, shirayich, we go all the way down. And again, that sense that there's a personal kind of conversation that's taking place between the paitan and the city herself. It's not distant in that way. He continues, Miyamu Mizrachu Mitzafum Teiman Shlom Rachok V'Karov Si'im Mikol Avarayach, from all the different directions, west, east, north, south. Again, the word shalom, which is clearly, right, this is yet another literary motif here, right, or technique here, right? This is what we generally call in modern Hebrew milamancha, in other words, a controlling word. Modern scholars have identified this as a common technique that we find in biblical writing in Tanakh, that there's a certain phrase in Tanakh that often repeats seven times or multiples of seven. Here it doesn't have seven times, but clearly there's an attempt at the beginning in particular to stress the term shalom, which of course itself has a dual meaning, right? Shalom means both, right, shalom, peace, or welfare, as well as a greeting. And again, so there's that sense of the intimacy of the personal caring, a personal greeting, as well as concern that is reciprocal, right? That's mutual, that goes in both directions between the Paitan and the city herself. Ushlom Asir Tikva, going back to the phraseology of the, or the imagery of the Asir, of the one who's in prisons, right? But look at this. Ushlom Asir, right? Here it says Ta'ava, that's generally printed Tikva. This is sort of an academic version that corrects some of the corruptions or various versions that are out there. Usually it's Asir Tikva. Ta'ava is, right, it's a little bit different, but a similar kind of feel. Tikva would be, of course, hope, as in Hatikva, right? Ta'ava is desire. But Asir Ta'ava, in other words, the point is that we are imprisoned by our desire. We're not just physically detached from you, but there's clearly some sort of imprisonment with regard to our desire to see. You know, Tein Dema'av Ketal Chermon, who gives his tears, who tears as the dew of the Chermon, which, and by the way, we're not going to focus on this either, but certainly there are many biblical references here. Tal Chermon is a perek in Tehillim. That utilizes that imagery, v'nichsaf, which is kisufim, modern Hebrew also, for an incredibly intense desire, liridtam al hararayach, to have them fall upon your mountain. So here we are, right, off in the exile, and we are crying, right? There's a sense of near despondency, right, of this Asir Tikva, that we are so distant from you, and all we really want is just to go to places like Har Chermon and to cry those same tears in our Holy Land, on the Harim of Eretz Yisrael in particular. There's of course lots of not just personification, but the metaphors or the imagery here is extremely rich as well, and that's a piece of it. Livkot en utich anitanim. So this is right, anitanim. Right, you start to get there's some resonance here, right? Modern resonance as well. Ve'techalom shivat shivutech ani chinor leshirayach. Right, so here you have Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, which clearly draws, and this is fascinating because this is really a modern song written in the aftermath of the Six-Day War and all the national pathos that we experienced at that time. Where do we draw from? Where is the chorus coming from? Right, where does Naomi Shemer draw from? Right, as a non-observant Jew, she turns back to the great lover of Jerusalem, to review the Halevi, one of the most deeply traditional personalities of all our heritage. So you have that. But I think that it's not ani kichinor. He doesn't say I am like a harp, l'shirayach. Right, which is itself is a beautiful image, right? I am like the harp, but it's not what it says. It says literally ani chinor. It's not just a comparison. There is an equation. The human being transforms into a harp. Right? I am the tool. I am the musical instrument through which your shirin, your praise, is sung. Ani chinor l'shirayach. And so, using, I believe, that very instrument, Naomi Shemer writes the song, drawing on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi here. He continues and describes his intents, and there's specific references to various locations in Eretz Yisrael. If you jump one stanza, you also see more of his extraordinary alliteration. And also, again, the sense of the intimacy, the sense that Yerushalayim, that the sanctity of Yerushalayim is not some distant, rational kind of theoretical construct, but rather as real as alive. And he writes, Shama Shechina Shechunalach, here they say Shechunalach, V'yotzreich patach l'mul sha'arei shachak she'arayach. Again, some changes here from the traditionally printed text of the Kina. But again, you get a sense of the alliteration. Sham Shechina Shechunalach, right? L'mul sha'arei shachak she'arayach. Right? You hear the shin, it's alive, and it goes back to shalom. There's a resonance of that desire for peace. And so it really captures and really hones in on the intensity of the emotion and picking up on previous motifs so that they're not just sort of left hanging, but they continue moving forward. And this is a key piece as well. I mentioned last time that Rav Soloveitchik has a pretty moving presentation that was recorded, that was set to writing by Rabbi Jacob Schachter, Rabbi J.J. Schachter, in his book, which compiles the Rav's teachings over the course of many years in Boston, on Tisha B'Av in particular. It's actually, I believe Rabbi Schachter did it, he's his historian, and so he wanted to be as precise as possible. I believe that they're actually based on recordings. In other words, he didn't rewrite them or summarize the teachings of the Rav, he actually offered a written record, and that's what appears in that particular book. So in those maybe 10 to 12 pages or so that introduced Sion Halo Tishali from one, or I think it's multiple presentations of the Rav over the years, there's a very moving description that appears about some of these things. In other words, the Rav describes how, halachically speaking, for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, that we know that there's a debate whether or not the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael continues, or Yerushalayim continues, even once the Beit HaMikdash is no longer standing. It's clear that for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the sanctity is alive and well. It's as a halachic postulate, as a halachic position, you could never conceive the notion that just because the physical space is not present, clearly something is lacking, but the notion that the sanctity is gone, obviously the entire Kina is a repudiation of that notion, right? It's alive and well for Yehuda Halevi, and that's exactly what he describes so movingly. And it's not just a halachic construct, but it's a living construct. For him, clearly Yerushalayim is alive, it's if not well, it has its own emotional state and is profoundly linked to us. And he continues, and of course, so much of this goes back to what we discussed in the Kuzari. In other words, Yehuda Halevi's whole argument is that we should not ground Judaism on abstract philosophical notions. It needs to be alive. It needs to be impassioned. It needs to be palpable. And Eretz Yisrael, more than any other country in the world, really manifests that. We're fundamentally lacking something when we're not there. That's where Judaism is alive. That's where we are fully alive. That's where we can connect in a much deeper kind of way. Enough with these rationalist, philosophical argumentations that lack something. Let's write a book in which we don't just sort of offer those predicates and theses and develop theories as to how we can prove the existence of God. Of course that's important, but I think that's going to sustain our people through this exile. I've got something else coming for you. It needs to be real. It needs to be emotional. It needs to be compelling. This is, of course, education in the 21st century, both for parents and for educators who are unpaid and for educators who are paid, to put it differently, to do that job. So this is, I think, a very relevant and argument or presentation that speaks to many of the challenges of our time as well. He then comes to a particular theory that we discussed briefly in Katruk the Kazari, but I think is worth highlighting in his poetic context as well. And he continues skipping one stanza. Evchar l'nafshi lehishtapich b'mkom asher ruach Elokim shvucha al bechirayech. I would only choose for my soul to be poured out lehishtapich b'makom or b'mkom asher ruach Elokim shvucha al bechirayech, in the place where the Spirit of God is poured out upon your chosen ones, from the word Asher Bachar, the phrase Asher Bachar Banim Kol Mem, your chosen ones. In other words, what's Ruach Elokim? This is essentially a description of Ruach HaKodesh, or Nevuah, of prophecy, something along those lines. And he's, of course, going back to the ones who were chosen. Who are the ones who were chosen? The chosen ones are people like Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, those who lived in this land and were endowed with the Spirit of the Almighty. This goes back to a form of prophecy, right? And essentially what he's arguing is that that's the place, that's the source of Nivuah. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi follows the strand in Chazal that maintains that one can only prophesy in Eretz Yisrael in particular, because that's really a spiritual birthplace of the world, that is a conduit for real for real connection, and it's only there that one can, that the chosen one, and of course, it's only one who was chosen by God and has that sort of charismatic, that charismatic relationship, is able to really connect in that kind of way. And then, if you skip one more, he had spoken about also that it's the seat of monarchy, it's the seat of God, that it's a point of connection, essentially, between the upper world and our world below. And then, he says, I don't just want to be present in your land. There's actually something more than that I'd like to do. Mitznevi mishotei. He says, if only I could float. In the places where God appeared to your chozim and sirim, in other words, to your prophets, essentially. Choze is another word for a seer or a navi, but sirayach, again. And then he says, right, not just float, mi'asa lichnafayim. Again, the imagery is so rich, it's not, again, right? Who would fashion me a pair of wings? And I'll go very distant. Anid, again, you see more of the alliteration. Nidod, nadid, right? Anid, with the tre levavi be mitarayach, right? All this, the nuns, the, right, the bets here with the tufts, levitre levavi be mitarayach, right? It's just so rich, the web of even literary or right, the sort of audio connections between the language. And of course, levitre levavi is a beautiful play on words. Levitre levavi is a reference to the Brit Bein Habitarim, of course, to the covenant that God made with God, that God made with Avram Avinu in Bereshit Perek Ten Vav. And so he's harkening back. He's been talking about Bechirayach, the chosen ones, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, who wander in Eretz Yisrael. If only I could grow wings and wander to all the places where God appeared to them. But it's also Levitre Levavi Bein Bitarayach, right? It's Bitre Levavi, right? It's my own heart, right? So, right? And I would add as well, Levitre Levavi is a reference to that which is broken. At the Brit Bein Hamtarim, the Vayvatero Tamatavach, the animals that were part of that vision or that covenant were split into two different segments, and Avram walks through the middle. So the idea that it's a split, in other words, Rabbi Yehuda Levi describes himself as brokenhearted here. Right, through that very same imagery, and my broken heart, all it desires to do is to be there together with you. And just to mention, this is relevant to some things earlier in the Kina as well, but it harkens back to what we said last time. We use the comparison to sort of romantic literature, where the central problem, that the Rav made this point as well, that the central problem, challenge for the medieval knight or for medieval romantic literature is physical distance. And there's no way to communicate, there's no way to connect. We have this incredibly intense emotional relationship, whether it be in a loving context, as Rita Levi had addressed extensively in his other kinds of poetry as well. But here, this is basically that same motif of love that is challenged by geographical distance, and it's just applied to an elevated topic, namely a relationship with God and with his land. And then also very famous, and this is where this, in a sense, this is where this comes from. Epolia peali arteich, again the alliteration. I will fall to my face upon your land, right? Epolia pe la apai ale arteich. Veirtze avanaych meod vachonina tafarayich. I will desire your stones. Right, I will favor your dust, right, so you can see him, like people get off the plane, right, at Ben-Gurion, and they kiss the ground, right, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi beat them to that by some 8-9 centuries. Afki b'yamdi alei kivrot avotai, right, so now he's imagining himself at places like Ma'arah HaMachpelah, but the graves of the Avot, and v'eshtomein b'chevron, and I am just, I am stunned, or really, Eshtomeim from the word of Shmama. I feel a sense of desolation in Chevron. Alei Mivchar Kivarayach, upon the chosen graves. Again, Bechirayach, going back to Mivchar Kivarayach, and so on and so forth. And he goes on. He describes various locations in Eretz Yisrael, Har Ha'avarim, Hor Ha'ar, where Aaron and Moshe respectively are buried. Right, it's like he's going on Google Maps and he's just imagining himself going over, right, hovering above each of these locations, and he's there, if not in body, then certainly at minimum in spirit. He describes that the sense that that life itself is drawn from the air of Israel. Chai in the third, or the second full stanza on the second page, Chaye neshamot avir artzeich. It is that the air of your land is the source for life. And then he desires to walk barefoot again, right? That he should have an intimate or physical connection with the land. Yin am l'nafshi, it would give no'am, it would give pleasure to my soul. Halo charom v'yachif, alei charvot shemama shayu dvarayach, to just simply walk literally naked and barefoot upon the desolate parts of your land, asharyu dvirayach, which were your home, dvir. Which is also a reference to a word or this speech. B'mkom aronech, the place of the aron, asher nignaz. Is that very interesting as well, that there's a debate as to where, in the Gemara itself, as to where the aron is buried. It's not just an issue that arises in Raiders of the Lost Ark or in other places in popular literature, but it's here as well. Chazal already discussed it. For Rehuda Halevi, of course the Aron is buried in some mysterious place deep beneath the land of Israel. Right? It's not even in the Vatican, right? It's just buried somewhere very, very deep in the land of Israel, because what other place could you imagine could be the source of such sanctity, the proper place for that which is so deeply intertwined with the Kiddushat HaMakom. This is just a seich. There's more here. He talks about how he can no longer eat. It becomes a little bit more down. He describes how he has to simply drink himself in order to sort of numb the pain, and the sense of pain at the distance and at the disconnect. And then he not surprisingly returns at the very end with a prayer for the return of the Beit HaMikdash, for the destruction of our enemies. If you go to the last few stanzas on the final page, starting at the top of the last page, it says Yishne v'achlof kalil kol mam l'chot he'alil, that the idolatrous or ungodly kingdoms should be completely destroyed. Chasnech le'olam ador v'dar nizarayach, that your chosen ones last forever. Yivach l'moshav elokayach, that you have desired also, yivach l'moshav, which you recite yichavot every morning as part of Sukkot Zimra, that you have chosen or you have desired really to the, as the settling place, dwelling place of your land. How fortunate is the man who chooses and comes close and dwells within your courtyards. How fortunate is the one who awaits and approaches and sees the dawning of your lights, and that the darkness is split open. Right, going back to that theme as well, to see the goodness of your chosen ones, returning to that theme, to rejoice in your happiness, again the sense of reciprocity, going back to the Shin theme motif, when you return to your earlier state of nurayach, of youthfulness, of course going back to the Psukim in Yirmiyahu, which describe lechtech acharai bamidbar, that we went after God in that state of na'arut, so to return to Yerushalayim and God Himself is at work, v'yachol, that state of youthfulness which we yearn to return to. So this is the power of what it means to be a poet. This is the power of someone who understands that Judaism is not just an intellectual discipline or even a discipline of actions, but really is a romance. And he felt that this is who he was, right? Obviously, when he made Aliyah, right, it wasn't just because he thought it was a good decision in the rational sense. It's almost as if you get the sense that he had no choice but to make Aliyah. If someone feels this way, there's really nowhere else you can be. And that's who he was, but that was also what he felt was the need of his generation. And of course, the pathos remain with us till this day. So I felt that we'd be derelict if we didn't give this a look and just see the kind of... and this is what we've produced. This is ours. And there should be a symmetrical sense of inspiration and pride in the kinds of texts and meaning that we've produced over the generations. And I read something like this and there are goosebumps. Because it's really just something to be really, really proud of and to be inspired by and with. Okay. Good. So the next personality That we're going to look at, again, just briefly as a sort of a segue or bridge to the Rambam, is the Rimigash. Rabbi Yosef ben Meir ibn Migash lives from 1077 to 1141. Overlaps.
Sorry, can you just give the name again?
Sure. The Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash, or the son of Meir ibn Migash, in Hebrew generally spelled Mem Yud Gimel Shin. He lives, his years are 1077 to 1141. Just to give context in relationship to the Rambam is born, there's some debate actually as to when the Rambam is born. It was traditionally given as 1035, maybe it was 1038. So the Rambam overlaps with the Rimigash for only between 3 and 6 years. So clearly there wasn't. The Rambam surely was precocious, but still. They don't overlap too much, but the Rimigash is particularly important as a transitional figure. Because on the one hand, he studies from draws heavily from the traditions of the Gaonim, and in that sense serves as a bridge coming from one place. And he's also the primary teacher, the primary Rebbe of not the Rambam, but the father of the Rambam, from Maimon. And so he becomes particularly important. And the Rambam, again, even if he didn't study in a meaningful way with the Rimigash, nonetheless, maybe he met him, maybe he didn't, we don't even know that. But clearly the Rambam quotes him more prominently and with greater reverence than many other personalities, and he becomes, especially on the halachic side, an important influence and indirect mentor, at least, for the Rambam. The Rimigash spends most of his life in Lutsena, which is, of course, a Spanish town. He's a rabbi, he's a posek, a Rosh Yeshiva. He's perhaps most likely born in Seville. We really don't know too much about him. And one of the key points in terms of the transition, or the bridge that I mentioned from the time of the Gaonim is particularly significant, because we know that the great sage of Lutsena toward the later parts of his life was none other than the Rif, or Yitzhak Alfasi. And so the Rimigash becomes a crucial, again, transitional figure as a student of the Rif, and then as the teacher of the Rambam's father. Clearly, he has this incredibly important role to play. It's unfortunate that we don't have very much writing from him. We have some recorded from the Rambam. We do have some commentaries that have recently been found, I believe, in the Geniza, although I'm not certain offhand, and that are published. But we don't have all that much from him. I believe we have a commentary of the Rimigash on Masechet Shavuot, one of the tractates of the Gemara. But beyond that, we don't have a ton. I'll give you a quotation from the Rambam. This is the Rambam in the beginning of his commentary to the Mishnah, and he describes the contributions or the stature of the Rimigash as follows. He says, "The Talmudic learning of this man amazes everyone who understands his words and the depths of his speculative spirit, so that it might almost be said of him that his equal has never existed." His equals never existed. Now, this is the Rambam writing. The Rambam is not exactly one to be impressed by anyone or anything. The Rambam said it like he thought it was, and had extraordinarily high standards of scholarship, of competency. So for the Rambam to write such high praise of anyone is a remarkable statement in its own right, and ashrei to the person who the Rambam thinks so highly of them. They're probably one or two in a generation, so that's clearly quite significant, and is also telling in terms of the influence and the importance he has to the Rambam, in particular, again, as a halachic personality. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi actually also had a relationship with and eulogized the Rimigash in a number of poems, as many as 6 poems dedicated to just one person. That's pretty good. Again, God willing, by all of us, that someone should dedicate 6 poems to speaking of our legacy and our contributions. That's not bad. The greatest Jewish poet of your generation. So that's just a sense. The truth is that there isn't all that much more to say about the Rimigash in the sense that we just don't have that much from him. But I think it's important to not overlook as we transition into the Rambam himself, and he deserves some attention. Okay. Good. All right, we're now ready to transition a little bit to the Rambam. and to at least frame our discussion with some of his biography. So the Rambam, Rav Moshe ben Maimon, born in the Spanish town of Cordoba in, we're not really sure what year, which is remarkable given the voluminous writing on the Rambam. He's born either in, as I said, 1135 or in 1138. There is some controversy. That was traditionally assumed to be 1135. It actually does matter more than just a bunch of historians trying to earn some money by publishing something. But it matters because, as we'll see, the Rambam is essentially expelled from his home for all intents and purposes at a young age. And how long he lived in that area in Cordoba as a young man could be significant in terms of his biography. But be that as it may, he passes again in 1204. So the Rambam lives for approximately 69 years. He lives about half his life in Spain, the second half of his life predominantly in Egypt, in the town of Fushtat, which is Old Cairo. And Fushtat is also the place of the Cairo Geniza, the old Ibn Ezra synagogue the attic of that synagogue is the location of the Cairo Geniza, which is one of the most significant windfalls in terms of historical materials, halachic materials, liturgy, and so on and so forth. There's just extraordinary wealth there, and although I think there's some writings of the Rambam, but what you find more is actually records from the time of the Rambam, from the community that he lived in. So just to give an example, case in point, they found documents referring to the tzedakah allocations of the leaders of the community living at the time of the Rambam. And there are those who have suggested that some of those records, in terms of the extent of the need, speak to the Rambam's fierce opposition to sitting and learning in kolel. Which is interesting. In other words, the Rambam had such sensitivity to one who was dependent on the community for support, in part because he was looking around at his own local community in Fushtat and he saw the degree of dependency, and he recognized just how that can cripple a community. Whether or not, it was actually published as an article in the journal Tradition a number of years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so, whether or not that particular thesis is convincing, the jury's still out on that, but again, the kinds of insight into the life of the Rambam and the context emerge from that shul and the community where he lived. What are the basic outlines of the Rambam's life? So the first thing is just to contextualize. If he's born in 1135 or 1138, we know we've defined the golden age of Spain as essentially running from roughly 950 to 1150 of the Common Era, which means that the Rambam is born, as opposed to Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, who's born earlier during that time period, the Rambam is born at the very twilight of this time. So the Rambam is really the final figure in this rich tradition, which explains a lot of the controversy that the Rambam found himself in, because many of the positions that the Rambam held were controversial, but they weren't necessarily such dramatic departures from some of the kind of philosophical approaches that you would find among others living in Spain at that time. He's to a large degree drawing on that tradition, on those Muslim scholars who are drawing on the Aristotelian tradition, and the Rambam seeking to reconcile the Aristotelian tradition with the Jewish tradition. But the problem is that the Rambam sort of was a man out of time. The Rambam was a man who was born who came from a culture that was about to, if not completely die or expire, was really to some degree changing dramatically and yes, to a certain extent on its way out. And so the Rambam finds himself, as well as in subsequent generations after his passing, his writings and his thought coming into sort of culture comps, into tremendous cultural clashes with other approaches of thinking that, generally speaking, after this point, the Jews find themselves in predominantly Christian lands, whether it be Spain itself, which ultimately becomes Christian, as we know by the end of, by 1492, is clearly Christian, but France, as well, the Ashkenazic community, which the Rambam's writing don't necessarily always receive a tremendously positive welcome, because his ideas are extremely foreign for those communities. When your Gentile neighbors are bloodthirsty, and you see them as the enemy, so you tend, of course, to turn within. And you don't have models for convivencia, for sitting at the pub with your Gentile neighbor. Instead, right? Instead, you're scared to walk out of your home. That changes things. And so, in that kind of environment, the Rambam's sort of worldliness was extremely threatening and uncomfortable, and met fierce opposition. It was only one of the many reasons that the Rambam made lots of enemies. But that's okay, because it didn't seem to bother him very much. So we don't feel badly for him. I don't think he would have felt badly for himself. But that context is going to be extremely important for our conversation. In particular, the key event, and some would suggest in the entire life of the Rambam, was the rise of the Almohads, the radical Islamic sect, to power in 1147. At that point, so the Rambam is all of either 9 or 12 years old, depending on his birthday. But essentially, at that point, the golden age of Spain is over. The Jew status as the dhimmi is the protected minority, that they have to give a jizya, they have to give a certain kind of tax, that they have a certain kind of protection, of religious protection, physical protection, security, in exchange for this tax that they would pay to the predominant Muslim culture. That is over at this point. This is a completely different approach that is championed by this Berber sect, by the Almohads, and essentially the non-Muslims, the Jews, the Christians, have to either convert or be exiled, or off with their heads, which is not completely unfamiliar, to put it lightly. So that becomes a decisive moment for the Rambam, because the Rambam really, as we'll see, believes that not only is his life, but really the life of the future of the Jewish community itself is in tremendous danger. He believes that there was this culture, and this culture has now been eclipsed, and he is receiving letters, as we'll see later on, from different members of the Jewish community, all sorts of different places, with a sense, there's really a sense of apocalypse, almost, that the beginning of the end could be near, that this is a tremendous challenge to the continuity of our tradition, that scholarship, that just physical security are in danger. And the Rambam believes that at a time like this, there are false messiahs who are rising in Yemen, and the people, the communities, are incredibly confused, and they write a very famous letter to the Rambam. His response is captured in his classic Igeret Teiman. The Rambam believes that this is a community whose future is in tremendous danger. Internally, we have the Karaites remain strong when the Rambam is in Egypt, and that is a tremendous challenge for him, an ongoing challenge. The Rambam believes that the very future of our tradition, of our people, is in significant danger. And his sort of self-concept, his autobiographical reading, as nothing short of, as we'll see, almost the savior of this people, who can single-handedly ensure the perpetuity of our tradition, both philosophically as well as halachically, we will see that will have a decisive role in some of the sort of outsized self-concept that the Rambam ultimately develops in terms of his contributions to the continuity of our people. There's an outstanding book written by a professor, Moshe Halbertal, which is recently published. I enjoyed it immensely. It also got some great reviews, but it speaks for itself. It's absolutely excellent. And sort of the core thesis of this book is sort of this notion, sort of the self-concept of the Rambam, how the Rambam's reading of his own personal biography is sort of the place, or the sort of the sort of the sense that the community is almost in this precarious place, and that the very future of our tradition is uncertain. And remains unclear. And so the Rambam, taking upon himself single-handedly these massive, incredibly controversial projects, as we'll see, that much of that is born of this self-concept and this notion of b'makom she'enish yishtadel lihiyotish, and that our very future is very much in jeopardy. Okay, just to fill in some more of the details of his biography. So again, the Rambam is born in Cordoba. The Almohads rise to power. He, in 1147, he and his family flee. They flee Cordoba, they travel to a number of different Spanish communities, and they really become, as to some extent all of us are, exilic Jews. They become wandering Jews. They go from town to town to town, and again, this clearly shapes young Maimonides in very significant ways. Ultimately, the family settles. They settle in Fez in Morocco for some time, which is where the Rif had spent much of his earlier life. And was a decisive influence there. In Fez ultimately becomes fairly dangerous as well, and in roughly 1168, so the Rambam at this point is, let's say he's born 1135, so he's 31 years old, or he's 28 years old, all right? So he's in that area, late 20s, early 30s. His family ultimately decides to leave Fez as well. I believe that also becomes a dangerous area. It's really the sense of the tumultuousness, that there really is no terra firma, is very much part of young Rambam's life. Of course, his parents didn't actually call him Rambam, but that's a separate conversation. Anyhow, so in 1168, they actually move, not to Fostat, not to Egypt, but to Jerusalem. Or to Israel. They actually come to Israel. It's a very significant phase in the Rambam's life. A fairly well-known one. The Rambam actually has a letter describing what seems to be a visit to Har Habayit. There's some question as to what exactly the Rambam means by that, and you can imagine that different people interpret this letter in different ways, depending on their view about both halachic and especially halachic about going up to Har Habayit nowadays. But the Rambam clearly was there in the area. Clearly, the limitations that are upon people nowadays were not present at that time. What exactly it means and how it fits with the Rambam's general position about the sanctity of Yerushalayim nowadays and all of that is a separate discussion for another time, but that's a very powerful letter. We don't really know for certain why the Rambam's family left and went to Egypt. It's particularly interesting because the Rambam records a prohibition for a Jew to return to Egypt, to live in Egypt. This is something that comes up in the Gemara and the Yerushalmi. And in the Latter-day Authorities, but the Rambam actually moved from Israel to Egypt. There was a legend that is just a legend. Historically, it's been proven untrue. But there's a legend that the Rambam used to sign his letters by writing. Because there are three verses in the Torah that are quoted, and the Rambam quotes as well, as sources for one not to return to Egypt. So the legend was that the Rambam would sign all his letters with the phrase, "He who sits stands in violation of three prohibitions of the Torah every single day." My God, that's how he would sign his letters, because here he was, he had returned to Egypt. So this is a classic question, how it is that the Rambam came to leave Israel and to go back to Egypt. The simple answer is that his family simply couldn't survive. There was no way to support themselves. Israel was desolate at the time. There was really nothing there for them. There was barely a community, and supporting themselves was almost impossible. And so the Rambam and his family ultimately make their way to Egypt. By this time, the Rambam has a wife, Mrs. Rambam. That's pretty much all we ever know about the Rambam. He doesn't seem to have been a much of a romantic, at least as it comes across in his writings. So, although we don't know that much more about Yehuda Halevi's wife either, but the Rambam is not a romantic, I guess, in any sense of the term. So the Rambam, we don't know very much about her, but we know that she was a person. That's pretty much all we have. The Rambam had two sons. His most famous surviving son, Avraham ben Harambam, who spent many years after his father's passing defending his father from all his critics. But he and the family move in roughly 1169 to Fostat. He studies in yeshiva. He studies in yeshiva, and he begins slowly but surely to become a decisive influence in that community. Ultimately, later on in his life, he rises to the position of the leader, the political leader of the Jewish community and their representative to the government. So he certainly ultimately rises to a position of stature, not only as a doctor, as we'll get to, but as leader of that community. Now, around this time, there is a very key and decisive moment. Shortly after they settled in Fostat, the Rambam had one sibling that we know about. His name was David, or David, and his brother was a merchant. And the Maimon family decided essentially to, and this is part of the discussion that I mentioned earlier in context of Kolel, etc., how the Rambam did this and why this is different than depending on the community. It seems that depending on his brother, he thought was legitimate, because he essentially arrived at an arrangement whereby the Rambam would continue his literary activities and his community involvement, and his brother David would go ahead with the family business. And he traveled to various locations as a merchant, and so he would sail in different places, and to engage in trade. He takes a somewhat risky trip to India, where he felt that he could do better, and apparently the Ramban felt that this trip was ill-advised. And David decides to embark on this journey anyway, and word gets back, tragedy is struck, the Rama's brother had been capsized and died at sea, which is exactly what had happened. This was a devastating blow for the Rambam emotionally, and it also changed his life dramatically moving forward. It was devastating emotionally because of his extraordinary relationship with his brother. The Rambam describes in his letters how he became despondent, he became depressed. And when we think of the Rambam as a sort of like outsized, larger than life personality, I think of him as sort of the most sober Jew ever to have lived. Right? I mean, he's just a great rationalist, knew exactly what he wanted to do, who was incredibly passionate, but like I think of him almost as mechanical, not in a negative sense, in the best of senses, meaning that he had complete control, that he was always on the ball, that he was the most brilliant man of his generation. He was incredibly directed. I mean, the works that we're going to describe and the sense of mission and focus that they must have taken. I mean, his sense of concentration, his ability to manage and to juggle his intellectual pursuits, his community responsibilities later in life, his medical practice, and the way that he rose to the apex in each of every one of these areas, and is drawing on Aristotle, who is very much this kind of sober, intensely driven, mission-focused kind of person. The notion that the Rambam could somehow break down, it's hard to comprehend. That's exactly what the Rambam describes. Take his word for it. We don't have any other records one way or the other, but really since for a year or more, he was utterly despondent and felt that he couldn't go on, and was literally sick with grief. That's how devastating it was for him. And to me, it's really important because, again, it gives sort of a human aspect or dimension to who the Rambam was, and for me, that's sort of helpful. So that's why I love reading his letters. We'll talk about some of his letters later on, because they offer just a very different kind of side to him. And you just see his humanity and his compassion and sort of like this profoundly human being that sort of shines through all of this incredible ferocity and intensity and focus and drive. And I think it really rounds out his personality in a very significant way. The other piece to his brother's death is that it affects the Rambam's financial situation. It wasn't just that his brother had died, but his brother died with a tremendous amount of merchandise at sea, which itself was lost. The Rambam, I don't know if he was impoverished, or he certainly didn't have enough to just continue on his own, so the Rambam needed to turn to his own profession. He was opposed to this notion of Kolel, and or didn't have that option. Maybe the community might have chosen to support him, but clearly for him that's not an option. So the Rambam becomes a doctor full-time, and this has a decisive impact on his role in the community, because it really shifts, it really frankly detracts from much of his literary output. The fact that he was able to write anything at this time is truly remarkable. He did write the Mishneh Torah at the time he was practicing as a doctor, but it's pretty extraordinary that he did, but it's clear that puts him in a new direction. It also gives him sort of an international or a following, because now he becomes a doctor, not just for the Jewish community, but for the local community a local Egyptian community as well, and ultimately, of course, he rises to become the physician for the vizier, and that is well known. But it really emerges from this responsibility that fell upon him after the passing of his brother. Around this time, the Rambam starts publishing not just his halachic or Jewish works, but he begins to publish medical works as well. And those are published, many of those are published, have been translated by Dr. Fred Rosner. You can find the Rambam's medical writings. I just saw this. Who has them? We spent a Shabbat in Cherry Hill recently. Really, really nice. And Ken Panich is a doctor, and there it was. I was just looking at his bookshelf, and he had the medical writings of the Rambam translated by Fred Rosner. I asked him if he used that in his practice. I had a good chuckle around that. But the Rambam, if not caught up to modern medicine, certainly for his time was at the cutting edge, and many of his medical writings remain very much in the spirit of what we now know to be true. So I don't want to overstate this case and say that the Rambam, you know, had Ruach HaKodesh and knew about all sorts of, that he invented, really he invented antibiotics or that he came to understand germs or things like that hundreds and hundreds of years before they happened. And that clearly is not true. But many of the notions of healthy lifestyle, of not just being reactive, but of being proactive in terms of living a balanced lifestyle, of eating not too much food and eating in a balanced way, of getting physical activity, of that being a really critical part, that sense of an overall balance among those was extremely significant. And many of his descriptions of illnesses were spot on, and it's really fascinating. He's been credited of having written about asthma and diabetes, and described other things before they had certainly their current names and before they were fully known. Certainly refer to those as well. He did, on the other hand, accept certain principles that are not accepted. So he draws heavily on Galen, one of the famed doctors, and his theory of the four humors. And the Rambam accepts that as well, and that in that form certainly does not find. It's not accepted nowadays, but in general, just a sense of his brilliance and progressiveness in his medical writings as well, which is, again, a remarkable tribute. Just whatever he touched turned to gold is basically what emerges. The Rambam, toward the end of his life, becomes incredibly busy. Here you have a man who is already, and again, we haven't even touched on his halachic works or his Jewish writings at all. We're going to circle back and describe those in order, because those are going to frame many of our continued discussions. But the Rambam has a very famous and moving letter in which he describes his daily routine. And he basically would get up at some ungodly hour in the morning. He would, after tefillah, etc., he would walk something like 4 miles to the palace. It wasn't very close to his home. And then he'd come back. And by the time he finished seeing the Sultan and whoever, he was on his schedule. And then once he was there at the palace, there were all sorts of people who would pile in, and they would ask to see him as well. And then finally, the Rambam would come back. He hadn't eaten very often. He would come, he would have a morsel to eat, and then people would, he would then, I think, at that point, the community, he was the Nagid for the community, he was the leader of the community, and he was just famous. People, there would literally be a line outside his door asking for his wisdom about every topic under the sun, personal, professional, related to the community work that the Rambam was involved in. And they would just line up, and the Rambam would take visitors one by one by one, like a Hasidic Rebbe or something like that. It might be rolling over to hear that, but he certainly did not take that kind of approach to many things, but certainly the notion that he was had this wisdom and he was happy to dispense and to be there for people, certainly. Happy or not, here they came. He didn't turn them away. And he describes that finally, by the end of the day, it would empty out at a late hour, and he would begin doing his medical research for the next day. Because as a doctor, he had seen all these patients and had all these cases, but he had to decide what to do the next day moving forward, and he had to spend then a number of hours doing his medical research. Right? And then at some point, he would actually do something called sleep for tower for much time at night, and he would get up early again, and he would do it again and again and again. This is all written in a famous letter to a student who asked the Rambam for a private audience to come and study, and the Rambam said, I would love nothing more than to sit down with you, but let me just be honest with you about what my day looks like and how much time you might or might not get with me. So the Rambam clearly, it's probably also fair to say that he probably exhausted himself. There are many historians who would say that it did lead to declining health. This is ironic for the Rambam, because the Rambam writes about not just in general living a healthy lifestyle, well, he does seem to get some good walking exercise in every day, but also in mental health, the Rambam actually writes about, I forgot to mention that earlier, but the Rambam has psychological insight as well, and it comes up in halachic context. He describes melancholy, he describes different kinds of therapies that can be used to address melancholy. He describes the impact of musical instruments, of going to a dark space in order to sort of be able to be meditative and get away from some of those troubles, which is fascinating. The Rambam clearly did not have any time to relax and to give him, you know, personal space or time or attention in any meaningful way this time. The Rambam also describes the importance of sleeping 8 hours a night. Which it doesn't quite sound like the Rambam made it there. So, you know, these are the tensions of someone who is of the stature of the Rambam and has dedicated himself wholly to the community. By the time he comes to the later stages of his life, he really is a celebrity. Everyone wants his attention. He can give something to everyone. He insists upon supporting his family and all of this, and just the massive responsibility is just overwhelming, even for someone like the Rambam. He never complains, he never says too much for me, but clearly it does have a meaningful impact. That being said, he also wrote the Mor Nevuchim at this time, so in between his spare time. And as opposed to most people, right, he didn't have Shabbos to write. So this is 6 days a week instead of in 7. The Rambam dies on the 20th of Teves, whatever the Hebrew year is, but it's we would call it in 1204, as I mentioned, after some declining health, perhaps related to some of these things. A point of clarification. We don't know for certain. I want to make sure that narrative is clear. There's no evidence. We don't know historically that we can say for certain that the Rambam's extraordinarily overwhelming responsibilities led to a decline in health and ultimately caused him to pass at an earlier time than he would have. I want to be clear. We don't know that. It's been reconstructed. It's been suggested by many. We don't know for sure, but you could put together the dots. That seems like it could well be a reasonable narrative, but I think it would be unfair for me to leave the impression that we know that to be the case. Maybe the Rambam handled all of it, and she just, you know, people 69 at that time was a fairly reasonable lifespan, so I just want to be clear. The Rambam, after he passes, after some discussion, it's possible that he was buried briefly locally in his home community in the local cemetery, and that he was exhumed and reinterred. We don't know that for certain, but there are many who suggest that the Rambam seems to have been buried in Tveria. Again, there's some question surrounding exactly where he was buried. Certainly, if you go to the Kever HaRambam nowadays, not to shoot anyone or anything down, but it's about as authentic as a lot of the other well-known, well-marked Kvarot in Eretz Yisrael. That's all I'll say about that, at least today. So we don't really know where he's buried. There are others who felt that he was buried in Egypt. There was such a tradition in the community there. One of the interesting things about the aftermath of the life of the Rambam is in terms of his impact. So clearly he had outsized impact. In particular, his connection with the community of Teman was particularly significant and deserved mention, and deserving of mention. I mentioned earlier the Igeret Teman, the Rambam, which we'll come back to in a later week. But the Rambam was considered so heroic, never having traveled to or met the people of Teman, but this letter was such an extraordinary lift pick me up for them, that they essentially adopted wholesale the rulings of the Rambam as the guiding principles for not, if not all, many of the halachic questions that arose in their community. Teimanim very often follow the Mishneh Torah, or have followed the Mishneh Torah historically, as their primary halachic text, and it's really a tremendous tribute to the Rambam. So we'll have all sorts of significant influences moving forward, as we'll see, both a positive and controversial, were well-received and controversial as well, but in particular, they have that influence on the community of Teiman. He is survived. Certainly, we don't know his wife for sure. We don't know exactly when she passes. But he certainly survived into adulthood. It could be that the younger child passed away. But Abraham, as I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Abraham ben Harambam, is the famed progeny of the Rambam. He succeeds the Rambam as Nagid. He becomes a court physician as well at a very young age. And the Rambam's family, which I didn't mention earlier, but I would be neglectful not to mention that the Rambam's family had been a prominent community in Egypt as well. They were court judges. They were Abatei Din in the Jewish community local as well. And the Rambam's family continued to hold the position in particular of Nagid, and to be involved extensively as scholars and leaders in the Jewish community for a number of generations and even centuries. There are also some famous statues of the Rambam. Fine. In Cordoba, I think there's a famous statue of the Rambam as well. That's another one. Where was it? I forget. And so, if you ever go on a trip to Cordoba, one of these Jewish history trips, you know what I'm talking about? You can go and you can go and see the statue. I believe it's standing ad hayom hazeh. So that's a quick overview, just in terms of what we'll be doing moving forward. What I'd like to focus on is the famous writings of the Rambam. We'll review them next time, but starting with his commentary to the Mishnah, we'll look at his halachic works. The commentary to the Mishnah is Sefer HaMitzvot, together with then his Mishneh Torah, his philosophical work, the Maror HaNevuchim, and to round it out with his letters and his responsa. Each one of these is absolutely fascinating and has a wealth of richness in and around it. We'll also examine some of the controversies that erupted during his lifetime around many of these works, the Mishneh Torah and the Maror HaNevuchim in particular, each controversial in its own way, in very significant ways that say a lot about the Rambam, say a lot about the larger community, and then have historical impact moving forward as well. We'll maybe touch on a little bit to really focus on this later on down the line, the Maimonidean controversy, but at least get a sense as to how he was received and some of the controversies surrounding his legacy moving forward after his life as well. There are two Maimonidean controversies in different contexts, one in Spain, one in Ashkenaz, that really rile the Jewish community. Once the Rambam comes along, it's just impossible to talk about halacha or Jewish philosophy in a meaningful way without going through the Rambam, whether because you champion him, whether because you think it was nonsense and heretical. Whatever you think about the Rambam, clearly there is no conversation anymore without the Rambam, as we'll see as we proceed. So that'll be the next few weeks. It's just so rich. And really rewarding to go through this material, and that we'll continue as we proceed.